Welcome to the Borat Minda podcast, a special Malaysian podcast on mental health. I'm your host Zuleika, and this episode is brought to you by AIA Malaysia for the AIA See the Other Side campaign that aims to drive conversations on mental health, lift the lid on mental health conditions, and break the stigma. In conjunction with Mental Health Awareness Month, we would like to encourage you to pledge your support for mental health awareness and well-being. For every pledge received, AIA will donate 10 ringgit to Malaysian Mental Health Association. So you can pledge your support by searching AIA See the Other Side. Links to the pledge form can be found on AIA and Minda Kami's social media. In this episode, clinical psychologist Dushka Tadic and I talk about what we can do to take care of our mental well-being. We covered the different domains that need to be considered when creating our own self-care plan, or our mental well-being toolkit, as Dushka likes to call it, which includes domains such as the physical, emotional, psychological, and social. She shares practical things we can do right now, as well as the importance of keeping it simple and starting small. Ready to build your mental well-being toolkit? Then keep on listening to find out how. Joined by clinical psychologist from Australia, Dushka. We're here to talk about some tips from an expert on how to take care of our mental well-being that we might not typically have come up with on our own, I guess.
Yeah.
What would you say are like the basic components in taking care of our mental well-being?
Well, it's a really exciting topic to talk about. And as I was just kind of saying off air, how do we summarize all of this information when there's just, you know, so much out there, so much is it that has been shown to help improve our mental well-being. So hopefully I'll be able to leave you with some concrete tips and strategies after this podcast. But when we're talking about our mental well-being, it's really important to remember that our mental health is not in isolation from our physical health or our social health or our emotional health. So we often need to take a holistic approach when looking at our mental well-being and, you know, looking at all of those components. So looking at our physical health, you know, what are we eating? Are we getting enough sleep? How are we looking after our body? Is there any illness, you know, physical illness that might be contributing to our mental health? We also need to look at our social, our social life and our social environment, because there's so much evidence that feeling connected and having social support is vital in improving our mental health, because isolation is one of those, you know, is a strong predictor of mental health issues. So considering our social sphere, I guess, and also looking at our emotional health, you know, how do we cope with emotions? What emotions do come up for us? You know, having an awareness of our triggers, you know, and how they affect our emotions. So, yeah, it's a holistic approach. Our physical, our emotional, social, and our mental health is all crucial at, you know, improving our mental well-being. So basically, yeah, someone who has a high level of emotional health is more resilient. So that's a term that's kind of thrown around a lot.
What does it mean? What does it mean to be resilient?
Yeah, well, being resilient means that basically you are able to bounce back from adversity more easily. You're able to cope with the challenges that life throws your way. Because we're all going to have issues, like struggles, aren't we, in life? You know, disappointments, losses, hard things that we go through in life. And so someone who's resilient has some tools and strategies that they can use to bounce back more quickly. So they tend to have more of a positive outlook on life and realize that when things are going wrong, you know, this too will pass. Nothing is permanent. So someone who has good well-being, these are the kind of things that would describe someone with good well-being and resilience. If you feel relatively confident in yourself and have positive self-esteem, if you feel and are able to express a range of emotion, if you're able to build and maintain good relationship with others, if you feel engaged in the world around you, are able to live and work productively, and if you're just able to cope with the stresses of daily life. So basically, those are the components that define someone who has good well-being, mental well-being, and resilience.
Let's say someone is trying to create a concrete plan on how to make sure that their mental well-being is taken care of.
Yes.
And we've already talked about like the different components of taking care of our mental well-being. What would that plan include? Like, what are your suggestions for the different components?
All right. So having a plan is a really great idea because, you know, as we just said, all of us will have times where we go through, you know, difficult things in our life. And having, I like to call it a toolkit, a mental health toolkit, is really important. And that's, I call it a toolkit because it basically can help people realize that there are practical things that we can do to make ourselves feel better. And so, you know, the common things that we often suggest address all of those components that we talked about. So the emotional, the physical, the social, as well as, you know, spiritual, if that's important to you, your spiritual well-being, your work life. So I often get people firstly to think about what's important to them and set some goals based around their values, because what makes you feel better will be different to what makes me feel better. For example, I might get a lot of satisfaction from my work, and that might be an area that can really help boost my self-esteem. So for you, it might be your social life and your friends and family that really give that to you. So I often get people to think about what is important to them in all of those different areas. How important is your spiritual life? How important is health, physical health, your emotional health, your work, your relationships? And then to think about which of those areas can be improved. So if you notice that, for example, you know, your relationships are really important to you, but you've noticed that, oh, you haven't really been engaging much with your friends and family, you've been withdrawing, well, then you can set a goal to spend some more time with family. Yeah. So setting goals around the things that are important to us is really important. And then there's a whole host of stress management strategies that have been shown to be really, you know, effective. And again, some of them work better than others, depending on the person. But things like exercising often is something that should be on everyone's list. Now, some people cringe. They go, oh, no, exercise. And I myself, was never a huge fan of exercise. But it absolutely helps us feel better, because when you are moving your body, your brain is releasing endorphins, and there's nothing you can do to stop that. You know, just by moving, your brain is releasing these feel-good hormones. And so it's just such a simple way to feel better. And there is so much research out there that shows the link between exercise and improved mental health. You know, exercise alone can significantly reduce the symptoms of depression and anxiety. So that should be something that's on everyone's list. It doesn't have to be really intense exercise. It can just be a 30-minute walk every day. So that's something that can be on your action plan. Sleep is the second big one that most people kind of underestimate. Mm-hmm. Sleep affects everything. So if you're not getting enough sleep, it's going to be very hard to kind of cope with the challenges that life throws at you. And, you know, we're more likely to be irritable and not able to manage our emotions as well if we're tired. Everyone's different, but generally around 8 hours sleep a night is what's kind of optimal for functioning. Then the other really important one is practicing mindfulness and meditation. So mindfulness is one of those terms that's been thrown around a lot lately. And essentially all mindfulness is paying attention to the present moment, right here, right now. So, you know, I just want listeners or anyone listening to this right now to ask themselves, okay, from the moment you woke up this morning to right now, at whatever time it is that you're listening to this, how much of the time has your mind been on the past? How much of the time has your mind and attention been on the present? And how much has it been on the future? And that's a really good question to answer, because most of us will say, oh, I've been thinking about the past, or I've been thinking or worrying about the future, and I haven't really been present. So often we are on autopilot, you know. I know I've experienced this, and most people probably have, you know, when you're driving somewhere and you arrive and you can't really remember how you got there, but you know you got there, but you weren't really being mindful during the drive because your mind was thinking about, oh, you know, what am I going to do at work today? What am I going to have for lunch? Or, you know, all the things that you need to do that day. So often we're thinking about the future or worrying about the past, and we're not focusing on the present. But we know that when we practice mindfulness, directing our attention to the here and now, it helps us control our emotions better, because when we're aware of what's going on right now, we can catch any, I guess, unhelpful thoughts that come up for us. We can catch those emotions early and then we can cope with them more effectively, rather than having our emotions kind of take us by surprise. So mindfulness is a big one. Practicing relaxation skills, that can be simply, you know, listening to music, you know, some calming music, or doing a progressive relaxation. So there's a lot of free videos on YouTube and so forth that take you through a guided relaxation strategy, where you kind of start from your head and relax all the muscles in your body all the way down to your toes. Again, that's, you know, bringing your attention to the here and now and to your body, But practicing those relaxation skills is a, you know, often mm-hmm. is a great way to ensure that stress doesn't build up. Keeping a stress diary is another common, you know, helpful thing to put on your plan. So this is simply just having a piece of paper handy and a pen, or you can even do it in your phone. There's lots of apps out there now, you know, free apps that you can log your mood and your thoughts on. So basically every time you feel a little bit stressed or anxious or worried, to just pause and write it down, you know, write down what's going on right here, right now for me. What is creating this anxiety and stress for me? And then you can kind of write down, okay, once you're aware of the thoughts that are causing the anxiety, you can think about how you can respond to that in a more helpful way. Connecting with friends and family is another really important one to have on your plan. Putting in regular time to spend with those that you love. And just keeping things in perspective. I think I mentioned at the beginning, you know, nothing lasts forever. So just like happiness isn't permanent, neither is sadness, neither is anxiety. Emotions come and go like waves. So reminding ourselves, you know, to keep things in perspective and not take life too seriously. And yeah, so there's a kind of a big list there of things that you can do. Mm-hmm. But what I recommend is once you've kind of looked at what's important to you, what do you value, and set some goals, the next step is to actually schedule it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, get a weekly diary and schedule in social time with those that you love. Schedule in the relaxation time. It might simply be 15 minutes, you know, every morning where you do listen to a mindfulness or meditation. But scheduling it in, because if you don't schedule it in, chances are it's not going to happen. And in order to look after our mental health in the long term, we need to build these healthy habits early on. So writing down a bit of a self-care routine is really important.
So I like to, I guess, sort of go through each of these things in more detail.
Sure.
So the first thought that I have is like, I know that a lot of people struggle with finding motivation uh-huh. to like exercise. Mm. And not only that, but I know that people, especially who struggle with depression,
yes.
find it really difficult to start, or, you know, typically people lie in bed
yeah.
most of the time, sleep a lot, or yeah, things yeah. like that, because that's what I go through. Yeah. How does someone deal with that?
Yes, that is a very good question. And it's something that we talk about all the time in therapy. And unfortunately, there is no magic pill for motivation. It would mm-hmm. be awesome if there was, but there isn't. The thing we need to remember is that action leads to motivation. Mm-hmm. So that, as you said, you know, starting is the hardest part, because you just don't feel like getting out of bed, or you're kind of worrying about, you know, thinking I can't do this, it's going to be too hard. And so all of these kind of thoughts just keep us stuck. So that's why scheduling is really, really important. So if you are setting goals based on your values, things that are important to you, you're more likely to stick to those goals. So if you're just saying, I'm going to exercise every day for an hour, but you don't really understand why that's important for you, or you don't really believe why it's important, then you're not likely to do it, yeah? So we need to take that first step and ask ourselves, why is this actually important to me? Why do I want to exercise today? Why do I want to spend, you know, meet my best friend for lunch? So asking us that question and writing down those answers, you know, what do I value? What's important to me and why? Having a why is very important. Yeah. Once you understand your why, you'll be slightly more driven to kind of engage in that behavior. Secondly, what's helpful is setting really small, concrete goals. So instead of saying, I want to get fit by January, mm-hmm. Or I'm just going to go to the gym 5 days a week. Well, if you haven't been going to the gym and, you know, at all, going 5 days a week is going to be a really hard task. So starting small and going, okay, I'm going to start by just doing a 15-minute walk every day. And you need to schedule it, like I said, in your weekly planner. When are you going to go? What time? Exactly what time? Is it going to be 9 o'clock in the morning? Is it going to be just before lunch? You know, when's it going to be? Because if you've written it down, you've already kind of half committed to doing it. Because mm-hmm. if it's in your mind and you're already not motivated, you're going to forget, definitely. I know myself, when I was trying to change my diet and eat more healthy, unless I had written down what I was having for dinner every night and I went and bought those ingredients at the start of the week, come Tuesday, I was having hot chips again for dinner because I just couldn't remember what is it that's healthy? What is healthy eating? I just didn't know. So you kind of do the preparation in advance really helps, you know. So schedule it in and set small goals. And another thing is, if you're really struggling with motivation, is to have a bit of an accountability partner. you know, so get your friend or a family member to kind of hold you accountable and check in on you and see, hey, you said you were going to go for a, you know, a walk at 9 o'clock. Come on, I'll come with you. Or, you know, just kind of give you a little bit of a push, because once you start, it's always easier. And, you know, motivation is up and down. Some days you'll feel more motivated than others, but the real reward will be once you see the benefits of that behavior. So once you've been walking for, you know, for a few weeks and you start to see that it's getting easier, you start to feel better about yourself, then the motivation will increase. So that's why we say the action is what leads to the motivation, because you automatically feel better once you've done it.
Mm-hmm. In terms of like starting small, what you said really reminded me of this comic. You know, there's a lot of things on Instagram.
Yes.
Like people drawing comics about what they struggle with.
Mm.
Yeah, I saw this comic about someone who was trying to get exercise into like part of their self-care, I guess.
Yes.
And this person was struggling with depression. And it's really difficult to start with, you know, taking that time to move your body. And what they did was like starting small, like I'm just gonna start by doing it for 5 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely.
It can be daunting to like think about, oh, I need to exercise for 30 minutes 3 times a day.
Yes.
But when you're like, your motivation is like pretty much at the extreme end of like not being there almost.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes she does it for 5 minutes. Sometimes she's like, I can only do it for 2 minutes.
Yeah.
But also like when you start, when you do 5 minutes, sometimes you're like, oh, I think I can hold on for like another 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So that's like a great reminder to like, I guess, make it less overwhelming. Yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Doing something is better than doing nothing. And start as small as you need to. Because even being able to tick off on your list that you've done, you know, 5 minutes of exercise is you automatically going to get that boost of endorphins because you've, you know, you feel proud that you did it. You did 5 minutes. And yeah, you gradually step it up. So don't, yeah.
Yeah. That also reminds me of like, you know, the accumulation of like the amount of time that you do really shows in the end. But, you know, it also reminds me of like this app that I use. I mean, I wish they were sponsoring me, but like I use the
promoted a lot.
Yeah, they probably don't know I exist, but like I use the Nike training app.
Okay.
I think, yeah, it's Nike training community, something like that. So yeah, what it does is like they have like, it's free and like they have a bunch of like exercises. Like for example, if you want to do yoga or like strength training, they have like really short ones, like 15 minutes, they have 30 minutes, they have 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And you can stop at any time, like if you just want to do like 5 minutes.
Yeah. Yep.
But I like the fact that, you know, at the top, at the homepage of the app, like they show you how many minutes that you've done.
Yep.
And that you get points as well. So it's kind of like a great motivator if you don't have, you know, anything like that. Or like,
absolutely. Well, as you mentioned, the points, the rewards are really important.
Mm-hmm.
So you might even set yourself a reward to motivate you, you know, to do that. So for example, exercise. So it might just be, okay, after my 5 minutes, I get to have a coffee. I can't have my coffee until I've done my 5 minutes. So it can be a bit of a motivator. And setting a timer as well. Like I know when I was at university and sometimes, you know, there were certain reports I had to write and I really, really kind of struggled with staying focused and writing for a long amount of time. So what I would do is again, it's free online. It's called a time bomb or something.
You
just in your browser, you type in time bomb and you just set for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I would say to myself, okay, I'm not getting up to go to the toilet or getting a coffee or checking my phone or anything for 10 minutes. I just need to solidly write. And after 10 minutes, I can do whatever I want. And you start the timer and then it kind of blocks out your computer or not blocks out, it's in the background and this bomb explodes after 10 minutes to tell you the time's up. But you'd be surprised at how quickly 10 minutes has gone. You know, and as kind of what you were saying before about you might do 2 minutes of exercise and think, you know what, I could probably do another minute. And after another minute, you think, oh, wow, that went quick. I could probably do another minute. And before you know it, you've done 5 or 10 minutes and you feel really great. So any of those practical little strategies, you know, apps or timers or, you know, like I said, getting someone to do it with you to be so you can be a bit more accountable, setting the small goals, anything you need to do to just get started mm-hmm. and then rewarding yourself for your effort will help ensure that you repeat that behavior.
Okay, let's, I guess, move on mm-hmm. from like, you know, physical
yeah.
in terms of moving our body to it's managing our mind and our emotion. Mm. How do we deal with stress, like daily stress? What are the strategies? What are the activities that we can do?
Well, all of those things that I kind of mentioned at the beginning, you know, including just making sure we're doing exercise regularly, making sure we're eating well, you know, that our diet is good, because there's so much evidence right now, then we're learning more and more about the fact that what we eat can really affect how we feel. And actually, you know, some people are saying that our gut is actually like our second brain.
Mm-hmm.
So the gut directly sends messages to the brain, which we didn't realize before. We just thought the brain communicates to the gut. But anyway, this communication goes both ways now. So that's why there's a lot of focus now on nutrition and eating the right foods, because that can definitely affect how we feel. So these are kind of more general strategies that we, you know, and good habits to get into, right? Looking after our physical health, eating well, sleeping, all of those things affect our mental health directly as well, even though we're not specifically focusing on the mind. What's important in terms of stress management day to day is just slowing down and being aware of what's going on around us and when we're being triggered.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's just say we're at work and all of a sudden we feel really stressed. Being able to, instead of just reacting to the stress, we need to just stop for a moment and go, okay, I'm feeling stressed right now. So labeling how we feel, being in tune to how we feel. I'm feeling stressed, or I'm feeling anxious, or I'm feeling worried. And asking yourself, what's going on? Why am I feeling that way? What is my mind telling me right now? Because it's not the situation that causes the stress and anxiety. It's how we interpret what's going on. So, you know, let's just take, for example, two teenagers going into an exam, and one of them is thinking, oh no, I haven't prepared enough, I'm going to fail. They're sitting there and they're feeling like really anxious, probably like a 9 out of 10 in anxiety. And then that feeling affects their behavior, doesn't it? So they might run out of the exam because they're too stressed. They might have a panic attack. They might freeze and not be able to think. Whereas another student is sitting there thinking, oh, you know, I've done the best that I can. I've prepared as much as I can. I'll just do my best. It's going to be okay. That person is probably only feeling a 4 or 5 out of 10 anxiety, and they're able to be a lot calmer and just get on with the task. So the aim is not to get rid of all stress and anxiety, because stress is important. It tells us that we need to do something. It motivates us to action, doesn't it? But when we have too much stress, it can actually inhibit our performance. So what we know is that when we get stressed, when we perceive that there's a threat or danger around us, so it might be an exam, or it might be a presentation we're doing at work, or any situation where we think something bad's going to happen and we perceive it to be stressful, that sets off the stress response in our body. So most people may have heard of the fight or flight response.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when we perceive a threat, our brain goes, oh no, danger. It releases cortisol into our body, which is really great because it helps us deal with danger if there actually is danger in front of us. Like if there's a car zooming towards us and we need to run really quickly across the road, that's great, that kind of burst of cortisol. But if we're just sitting at our desk trying to write a report, or we're trying to do an exam, and we've got so much cortisol in our body, we can't think clearly, because when the stress response is activated, the frontal part of the brain, the frontal lobes, actually shut down temporarily, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. we don't need to think in that moment. We, you know, we don't need to plan or make decisions or use our, you know, rational thinking. We just need to get away from the danger. So what a lot of people don't realize is that stress is this physical response that affects our mental response. And so we need to calm down the nervous system in order to be able to respond appropriately. So that's where the stopping and labeling the emotion. Deep breathing is really helpful at managing stress day to day. So when we're feeling overwhelmed, just taking 1 minute to just count our breaths and breathing in really deeply, holding on to that breath for about 3 or 4 seconds or longer if we can, and then exhaling, because that directly kind of goes against that stress response and helps calm the nervous system. And practicing mindfulness day to day is a great way to help us be more present. And I often say to people, just keep it simple. So we can choose, we can be mindful doing anything, like brushing our teeth, eating, driving. So pick something that you do every day. For me, I like to do it when I'm brushing my teeth, because I know I'm going to brush my teeth every morning before I leave the house. So use those few minutes when you're brushing your teeth or you're having your breakfast to just focus on that, yeah? So you're not thinking about work or thinking about what you have to do that day while you're eating your breakfast. You're purely focusing on how the food smells, how it tastes, you know, how it feels in your mouth and so forth, and just enjoying that moment. And that sounds such a simple thing to do, but it's actually really hard because our brain is wired to think ahead and to, you know, plan and then just keep be active. So I would say those things are, you know, are really great ways to manage our mental health and manage the stress day to day so that it doesn't build up. Yeah.
Let's touch on, you know, having a support system. Why is it important? And how do we build that support system? What does it need to include?
So, you know, time and time again, the research has shown us the power of connection and community. Connecting with others can help us feel a great sense of belonging and help to kind of challenge those feelings of loneliness. So we know that people who feel that they belong to a community are generally happier and tend to live longer. And I think this is because, you know, humans are social creatures. We can't do it alone. You know, we kind of evolved to be in groups and to be parts of groups because that groups provide safety, resources that we might need, and a sense of purpose in life. So reaching out and having a support system is really important because not only can it help you feel understood and listened to, and we know that just simply talking and getting our thoughts and worries off our chest can, you know, have a really positive effect. Because often just verbalizing what's happening to us, what we're experiencing, can really ease the distress that we're feeling rather than just keeping it in our mind and going over it ourselves. So just verbalizing it and sharing with someone that we trust can have that therapeutic effect. And often, you know, when we're feeling so overwhelmed, we're kind of in our own little bubble, and it's really hard when we're in that bubble to see things from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And when we feel so down, for example, or so worried, our brain tends to look for evidence that fits with how we feel. So, you know, if I'm feeling really anxious, I will just notice everything around me that is proof that something bad's going to happen or that my worst fears are going to come true. And that's just how the brain works. Whereas once we turn to other people and share how we're feeling, they're not in our little bubble. They're not feeling the distress. So they're able to look at the big picture and perhaps give us some perspective and, you know, provide some solutions that we might not be able to think of ourselves. But more than anything, they don't want people to fix the problem for them, do they? You know, they just want someone to listen and to understand and validate how they're feeling. And that's just a part of innate part of being human. You know, we want connection and we want to feel understood. And that's why having a support system is crucial. So how do you go about building that? For people who are lucky enough to have a lot of family support and friends, you know, I would obviously say to start there, to turn to your family, turn to your friends, let them in on what's going on for you, be open about how you're feeling. Also, there's a lot of support groups out there. So whether online or in the community, there's a lot of people who are experiencing the same thing that have kind of formed groups to share their experiences and help support one another. So I would suggest, you know, just searching online for, let's just say it was someone with OCD, you know, OCD support group, and looking for any support groups that are in your area. You might even consider starting your own support group if there is nothing around. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the platforms would be in Malaysia. I haven't come across anything yet. I know that in Australia there's a website called Meetup. Mm-hmm. And it's for people to form all sorts of groups. It can be mental health support groups. It can be crochet groups. It can be chess mm-hmm. groups, anything at all. And people who have that similar interest kind of just join the group and they organize to meet. So there's a lot of groups on there, you know, people struggling with anxiety, and they get together once a week, for example, and go out and connect. So you might think about starting your own group. I would like I said, turn to people that you know first, obviously, and then if not, look for some peer support groups around you. And if that isn't enough, then definitely seeking some professional help. It can be really good to have a professional in your circle who can kind of help you troubleshoot what's going on, you know, teach you some mm-hmm. skills and strategies to cope and kind of guide you along as needed. It doesn't have to be weekly. It could just be checking in once a month, you know, with a psychologist or a counsellor to talk through how you've been coping, what's working, what's not working. Again, it's the talking through these issues that's just so powerful, because it gives you an opportunity to reevaluate what's working for you and what's not, and come up with some other ways. mm-hmm. of coping. Yeah.
There have been some people who have asked our organization, yes. like, you know, why would I pay for someone to listen to me when I can just do that with like a friend and sure. get it over with? Yes. What makes it different to have like a counselor or a clinical psychologist?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good question. And yeah, I'm sure that many people will have that question. Well, I think talking to your friends is absolutely important because they know you better than anyone. They're there. You can always turn to them when you need. But often what can happen is that, you know, friends or family might be scared to say something because they worry they're going to make it worse for you. And so they may not, you know, be as available or be as present as you need because they're worried that they're going to say something wrong. And other times, you know, I guess family and friends are not trained in understanding what causes mental health problems mm-hmm. and the most effective treatments. So seeing a professional like a psychologist is not just about talking about your problems. That's definitely part of it. But a psychologist is someone who's trained in human behavior and specifically trained in mental health. And so they understand the factors that work together to contribute to, you know, the symptoms that you're having. And they also know the effective treatment to mm-hmm. provide. But because there is actually evidence-based treatments, which means that the strategies and tools managing our thinking and behavioral, managing our behavior. Yeah, there are specific strategies that have been shown to be effective at treating these mental health issues. So I would say that seeing a mental health professional like a psychologist will mean that you get the best possible treatment because it really is about learning skills. It's not just about talking. Psychologists are there to teach you skills to cope better with life stresses.
Yeah, you're equipped with the skills that you can then teach other people. And like,
that's right.
Normal people that you meet, like your friends and family, don't necessarily have that list of things that you can do, the strategies that you can implement in your life.
That's right.
Also, another thing that's commonly asked, especially in Minda's social media and like private messages, people always ask, do I need to see someone? How severe do I need to be to, I guess, be able to see a clinical psychologist or, yeah.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, that's a good question. Like I said, we all have bad mental health days, right? So we'll all have days where we wake up and just everything feels so hard and we don't want to get out of bed or we're really anxious about something that we have to do that day or that's coming up. So anxiety, low mood, they're all normal emotions. Every single person experiences these. But how you know when you need to see a professional like a psychologist is if these emotions persist for a long amount of time. So we're talking, you know, several weeks or more where you're just not able to shake that feeling. So if for 2 or 3 weeks you can't get out of bed, you can't function like you normally would, that's when it would be time to speak to somebody. So we look at the length of time of distress. So if you've been, you know, experiencing the anxiety or low mood for a long amount of time, we look at the severity of the distress. So if it just feels unbearable, like nothing that you do, you know, you've tried to get enough sleep, you're eating well, you've tried talking to family and friends and nothing seems to be helping you feel better, that would be an indication that you need to see a psychologist. And the third one is if it's really starting to interfere in your life. So if you're starting to avoid doing things that you used to enjoy doing and just can't seem to show up to your sport activities like you used to or get to work like you used to, or, you know, you're avoiding socializing. So if it's stopping you doing the things that you normally would do in your day-to-day life and you just can't seem to get back into it, that would be another pointer for when you need to see someone. So it's the level of distress and the level of interference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people think that, you know, therapy is exclusive to someone with a diagnosable mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of like shies them away from, you know, getting into therapy. Yes. What do you think about that? Like,
yeah, I would totally agree with that. You know, I've had friends just recently, for example, one of my good friends wanted her daughter who's experiencing some quite significant anxiety, and she was asking me whether she should see a psychologist. And her biggest concern was, what if she gets a diagnosis and this follows her for the rest of her life?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So it's a very common fear that people have. And what I would say is that actually most of the time psychologists don't even give a diagnosis unless it's absolutely needed. For example, children who need to get some additional supports for ADD or autism or things like that, because there's some national schemes that provide extra funding for those children, mm-hmm. for example, extra supports at schools and so on and so forth. At those times, you can see how a diagnosis is quite important, because it helps, you know, get the right resources in for that child. But generally, we don't focus on the diagnosis in therapy. I myself don't even talk about diagnosis unless it's absolutely necessary. What we focus on is what symptoms are interfering in your life right now, like what symptoms are causing you distress, and what can we do to improve your life right now? That's mm-hmm. essentially what going to therapy is about. It, mm-hmm. You know, you as the client, when you go to therapy, the psychologist works with you collaboratively. So, yeah, the psychologist is the expert in mental health disorders and human behavior. But a client, someone coming to see us, they are the expert in their own lives, you know, in their own histories. They are the experts in what they want their life to be like. So a psychologist's role is really to work together with the person to help give them strategies to reduce the distress if they're experiencing significant distress, and to help them work towards their goals. It's not like the psychologist tells you what you have to do in your life. We're just there to help you learn about yourself, learn about your triggers, your thoughts, your beliefs, and how that's influencing your day-to-day life. So people who are worried about a diagnosis, that, you know, really shouldn't be, because even if a psychologist hypothesizes, okay, this person might have, say, depression, this isn't kind of written down anywhere or sent out to anybody. No one will know. It, you know, it's not really an important part of what we do.
Yeah. So we've learned a lot about like the different components of what a mental well-being toolkit could include, whether it be physically, emotionally, psychologically, in terms of like having a support system, having strategies like exercising, mindfulness, writing stuff down, scheduling stuff, starting small. So that's been really helpful. As someone who's like listening right now and wondering, how do I start? Like, what would the first step be after listening to all of this? Because it sounds like a lot.
Yeah. And like I started saying at the beginning of this podcast was, wow, how do we kind of convey all the information that's out there on, because there's so many things that we can do that are helpful, but some things will be more helpful to others, you know, depending on your interests and what you've already tried and what, you know, every person is different. So my suggestion would be to, you know, get out your phone or get out a piece of paper and write down my wellbeing toolkit. And just dot points underneath that heading, write down the things that up until now, you know, have helped you with your well-being. So this requires a bit of, you know, reflection. And I think that's so important because, again, mindfulness, we're always on autopilot. We're just doing things that we've always done. Mm-hmm. And nothing can change if we keep doing what we've always done. So hopefully after listening to this podcast, people will be motivated to go, okay, I want to ensure that I have a good self-care plan or a good well-being toolkit moving forward, because we're all going to need it. We all need our well-being toolkit. And so I would say actually take the time right now to reflect on what has worked for you up until now in your life. Do you know that when you feel overwhelmed, if you just make sure you get a bit extra sleep, that really helps you? Or is it the exercise? Or is it eating well? Is it connecting with family and friends? So just one or two words, write down the things that have been helpful for you up until now. And then maybe add to that list the things that you haven't tried yet, but you think you might like to try. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we talked a lot about relaxation and mindfulness, and that's a skill that takes a lot of time to develop. You know, I have to practice it myself daily, just remind myself, okay, be in the moment, focus on the here and now, don't worry about the future. So you might put down mindfulness, for example, and I just want you to schedule it in your week. How are you going to practice mindfulness this week? Is it going to be, you know, every time you eat your meals, or is it going to be while you're brushing your teeth, or if you go for a walk every day, you know, being mindful during your walk? So just making that list and taking the time to reflect on what has worked for you and what you might like to try. The only way we'll know what works for us is through trying these things for a little while and seeing how it makes us feel. And, you know, the ultimate goal is to feel in control, isn't it? To feel that, you know, build resilience, as we said. Difficult things will happen in life, we can't avoid stress, we can't avoid anxiety. All of these emotions are normal and we all feel them at some point. But feeling that we have a good toolkit that we can use when these emotions do creep up, when we're starting to feel too stressed or too anxious, that we've got some things that we can use and overcome, you know, the stresses more easily. So the more we practice using these tools, it's like learning to ride a bike. We can read about learning about how to ride a bike. You know, we can read 50 books on how to ride a bike. It doesn't actually teach us how to ride a bike unless we get on that bike and we might fall. You know, the first time we ride it, we might fall. The second time, you know, we might fall less. But the more we practice it doing it, the easier it becomes. The same thing goes for mental health. We can talk about it. We can read about it. But unless we practice the skills, we're not going to get better at it. Mm-hmm. So I would say, you know, write down your mental health, your well-being toolkit and schedule in time to practice those skills.
I don't know why, but like when you mentioned like we can read 50 books on like how to ride a bike, but that's not going to be something that actually teaches us how to ride a bike. And I guess that reminds me of like as someone who has a mental illness and has read so many things about like how to take care of your mental health over and over again.
Yes.
But I've noticed recently that I've not been really practicing what I know could help. Like I have like over the past year or so, I have been in therapy and that's something that has helped me.
Yeah.
But that's also one thing, like one of the components that I do.
Yes.
I guess that's in my toolkit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when I'm not in therapy, then I've noticed that I don't really do much. Yeah. And it's good to remind myself, I guess, that unless I put in the work, unless like I go through that process of like, for example, grieving over something I've lost, then I won't be able to move forward from that. So yeah, I think that's, I guess, a really great reminder of like sometimes you read about something so much, but that doesn't equal to you having practiced that.
That's right, having the effect of it. No, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that we can get so overwhelmed these days. There's so many self-help books out there. There's so many websites on how to, you know, deal with all sorts of mental health problems. And the more we read, we can just get really confused. So I think trying to remind ourselves that we need to keep it simple. And this is hard work. You know, it is. And as you say, I mean, there's varying degrees of severity of mental illness. So all of us have bad mental health sometimes, but people who are struggling with severe mental illness, it can take all of their energy just to get out of bed in the morning, you know. So we can't underestimate how important it is to just focus on the simple things like getting up and getting dressed and doing 3 minutes of exercise or making sure we actually eat breakfast, you know. So, you know, what you do and what your toolkit looks like will be very personalized to where you are at in your life and what, you know, I guess where we are on that continuum. But I would, you know, say to keep it simple and to not stress ourselves out of reading too much and trying to do everything at once, but keep it simple and look at those main domains, the physical, the emotional, the social, and the mental. And just write down what is the one key thing that helps you in each of those domains. So how can you look after your physical health? And, you know, for you, it might be, right, I'm really going to focus on my sleep. For someone else, it might be, I really need to do exercise. You know, for someone else, it might be, I'm really going to focus on my diet. Just pick one thing, you know, and then in social, okay, what can I do to ensure that I'm looking after my social life? Okay, I need to spend more time with my family, or I'm going to have lunch with my best friend once a week. And just to set those simple goals and to be okay with taking it slow and realizing that everyone's different and everyone's journey is different. And that's where that self-reflection really is important. Taking the time now and then to go, okay, how is my toolkit serving me? Is it, how am I feeling lately? If it's not working, what can I change in my toolkit? You know, oh, wait, you might notice I've completely, you know, ignored everyone for a month. I haven't actually had any fun social activities. Oh, I really need to focus on that sphere of my well-being. Or you might notice, wow, I've really not been eating well at all lately. I'm going to focus on that. So, you know, picking one thing at a time and giving yourself a break, because it can be really, really hard.
So I guess sort of like to summarize, you know, do reflection, keep it simple.
Yes.
And start small.
That's it.
And we've already talked about what sort of things that you can include in your toolkit.
Yeah, there's lots and lots of things you can put in your toolkit. But those main principles that you just summarized are really key. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Borat Minda podcast, and we've been talking to clinical psychologist Dushka. And thank you so much for being on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Borat Minda podcast. This episode was brought to you by AIA's See the Other Side campaign. Remember to visit their website to pledge the support for mental health awareness, as AIA will donate 10 ringgit to MMHA for every pledge received. Remember to subscribe to the Borat Minda podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. And follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at the handle MindaKami. If you'd like to learn more about AIA, one of Malaysia's leading insurance providers, visit aia.com.my. Until next time, remember to take care of yourself. Goodbye.